The National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis generated a lot of enthusiasm among Catholics, but was it successful in its mission? We're going to talk about both the highs and lows of the Congress today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sims, your host, editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, you know what to do. Smash that like button, subscribe to the channel, let other people know about it. We're on YouTube, we're on, I think we end up being on Rumble and Odyssey as well. We go to all the major podcast platforms. So just let other people know about it. I find it funny. Sometimes I'll find people who follow me on Twitter won't even know I have a podcast, even after following me for a while. So let people know about it. Also, you can subscribe to our email newsletter. Just go to crisismagazine.com, put in your email address, and we will not spam you. We will just send you articles. Follow us on social media at Crisis Mag at all the major social media sites. Okay, so the National Eucharistic Congress was last week in Indianapolis, and I was there for part of it. And so I just wanted to talk about it. I had a podcast about a month or so ago about it, whether or not, how we judge whether or not it's successful. But I want to talk about actually being there and what I thought of it and talking to people, other people who were there, and kind of give a recap of it. First, I just want to say that I had actually hoped to do a podcast live from the Congress itself. I brought my equipment. The problem was is that where we most likely place to do it did not have free Wi-Fi, and I didn't really feel like paying all the money for it because I wasn't 100% sure if it would work. Our cellular was really bad. Where we could have had it with free Wi-Fi wasn't a great place to set up. But anyway, I just realized, okay, got to scrap that. I was going to do it with Tim Flanders over at 1 Peter 5, but we decided not to. Also, this is kind of a funny thing. I really appreciate, first of all, the people who came up to me and said they enjoy the work we're doing here at Crisis. I did notice, however, that a good number of them kind of said it almost in a conspiratorial tone, kind of like, don't let anybody else here know, but I like what you're doing. Almost like, you know, I don't know that it wouldn't be approved by the masters there if somebody said that they liked what we're doing here at Crisis, because we can be critical at times. I know that. So I just kind of thought that was funny. But all those that I talked to there and that follow what we do, I do appreciate you coming up to me and having chatting. I love meeting people in real life who follow Crisis. Okay, so the Eucharistic Congress itself. Here's the thing. What I found is, because the age we live in, maybe we've always been like this, but definitely true and exacerbated on social media, you'll find people either saying, this was the greatest event in the history of the Catholic Church ever. It's going to change the whole church in America. Everything's going to be different from now on. This was just awesome. Or they will say, this was an abomination. This was terrible. It was Protestant. It was just awful. It was, I don't know, all the different things. They'll condemn it unequivocally. Well, I don't do that. And unless I think something really does deserve, you know, complete praise or complete condemnation. The fact is the National Eucharistic Congress was a product of the American church. And the American church, as we all know, has issues. It has its good and its bad. And so therefore, a product of that American church is going to reflect that. This was run essentially by the USCCB, the bishops. I mean, they had people doing the legwork, but the bishops, this is the bishops' congress. It was for, you know, they decided to do it. And so we all know the crop of bishops we have in America. There's some good, some really bad, a whole bunch in the middle. And so an event that they hold is going to reflect that. One thing to note is that just because of the fact that the bishops were organized this, you knew there was going to be a good crowd because of the fact that it now becomes an establishment thing that you can do in your parish and in your diocese. So dioceses can get buses together to go. Youth groups can get together and go with their parish because it's all approved. And you saw that with the March for Life at Washington, D.C. That's one of the reasons you get so many people there, is it's an approved activity. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I am saying it does kind of spike the numbers because things that you wouldn't necessarily, might be a good event, but they're not approved by the bishop, by the diocese, you're not going to get as many people going there. So the fact is, though, I found being there and also hearing other people's eyewitness accounts that there was some good at it, but it also had issues. And so I feel like if we just cheerlead for the Congress. What happens is we just continue with the status quo in the church, which obviously has not worked. We've had decades of status quo and decades of decline. That's just a reality. Now, I don't want to question the intentions of those who held the Congress, and especially not those who went to the Congress or attended, because of the fact that it's an effort to stop the decline. Okay, I'm with you on that. I support that. But how it was done does matter. It's not just good intentions, but the execution that matters. The fact is, we have lots of events in the Catholic Church, lots of events, conferences, retreats, conventions, all these different things. And nothing really changes on a macro level. Yes, I know individual lives are touched, and that's important. But when we talk about Congress of this size or event of this size, we do need to look at the macro level. I mean, I would say that if you look at all the events in America, Catholic events in America over the past, since Vatican II, really, only one, I think, moved the needle. And that was World Youth Day 1993 in Denver when JP2 came. I do think that moved the needle. You had a large number of vocations that came out of that, a large number of people who really did change their lives in a good trajectory. But even saying that, we all know that the church has been in radical decline since around 2000. I mean, we should know that. I've talked about it a lot here. So even that, when I say that 1993 World Youth Day moved the needle, it clearly didn't stop the decline or anything like that. It just did help in some areas. My prayer is that the National Eucharistic Congress, it just concluded, will be similar in moving the needle. But I'm skeptical of it, as we'll see here in a minute, of how much of an impact it will have. So I want to go through, I call it the good, the bad, and the ugly of the Congress. The first is that, let's say the first is the good. Let's talk about the good. I think the best thing about this whole Eucharistic revival, which includes the Congress and all the other stuff involved, it's a three-year program, was the National Eucharistic Pilgrimages, where processions happened all across the country, kind of making the form of a cross going into Indianapolis. So they came from the East Coast, West Coast, down south, up north. They all converged on Indianapolis. I thought that was a wonderful idea. And from a lot of the, and I, of course, I only went to when it came through Cincinnati, where I live. But from a lot of videos and pictures I saw, it was really well done in a lot of places. Now, we all know it wasn't well done in all places. I don't know if you saw the video of Cardinal Supich in Chicago. That was just awful. I mean, they were sprinting around a building trying to get back in. But in general, I thought that was a wonderful idea because I am such a huge proponent of Eucharistic processions. I think they're the great, I think it, the fact that they stopped being done essentially in the church in the 1970s and 80s is just a tragedy and is one of the reasons why we have such a lack of belief in the real presence of the Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. So whoever thought that idea, kudos to you. I honestly think it was the best thing about the entire Eucharistic revival was those Eucharistic pilgrimages that they had. What else was good? Okay, let's talk about the Congress. The Congress was well run. There was a little bit of a glitch on the first day that the lines to register to enter in were super long and took, I mean, just it was getting kind of ridiculous. Clearly, they did not, they were not prepared for the number of people who came in on the first day. You know, other than that, though, it really was professionally run. It was like things were basically on time. You know, there's plenty of facilities, like, you know, for the food wasn't that great, but I brought my own food. But there was food available. There was restrooms readily available. The convention center where it was at was very nice. All that weather was perfect. I know they didn't plan that, but it was very good weather. So I really do think that was good because these things can, I mean, I have organized small conferences, like maybe a couple thousand people. And that's a lot of work to do that. So imagine a four-day or whatever it was, Congress with tens of thousands of people coming from all over the country, all these different things to coordinate. That is a lot of work. And I respect the people who did it because they clearly knew what they're doing. I just saw in the comments somebody mentioned oh, Indianapolis is a fantastic place for a large conferences. It really is. I mean, first of all, it's centrally located in the country. I don't like everything's always being in like DC or New York, some of that. It's relatively cheap as far as housing and things like that compared to the big cities. And it just has a lot of facilities. I mean, there's a lot of things that you could do there. So I thought that was very good. So that I want to say that. Also, I want to give kudos that the traditional Latin Mass was celebrated on two different occasions connected to the Congress. I know some trads are like, you know, you're begging for scraps at the table or whatever. I just don't have that attitude. I recognize the reality we are in, that traditional Latin Mass is, first of all, a very small part of the Catholic Church and around the world, but including in America. And it's also very controversial, mostly because of our current pontiff. And so the Congress did not have to have any TLMs there. And it would have been the safe thing to do for them not to have any traditional Latin masses at the Congress. So I do want to give them credit that they did have to, including one celebrated by an archbishop. Archbishop Corleone of San Francisco celebrated one. I was at that at a nearby church. There was some controversy about the fact that it was in a small church that was about a mile away that you had to walk to or drive to. And I walked to it and I realized about halfway there, this is a longer walk than I thought on the map. And I was like, oh, shoot. But it wasn't that bad. But really, I think it was more just coordination. I would prefer to have traditional Latin Mass inside a church, a beautiful church, rather than in a hall at a convention center. And so the fact they had it in a church was nice. And it was a very nice looking church too, traditional church. And it's the TLM parish, and it is the closest church there other than the one that's right across the street from the convention center. But that was open the whole time for perpetual adoration. And I understand that that's a high priority. I don't criticize them for that. So I'm not going to be critical of that. So I say I'll put that under the good category that the traditional Latin Mass was celebrated. Also, they had some divine liturgy, Eastern divine liturgies. I think that's great. Expose people to the Eastern divine liturgy. In fact, I was talking to a friend of mine I saw at the conference, and I know she's attended the TLM many times, and she never attended an Eastern liturgy. So I told her, hey, go attend the Eastern liturgy rather than the TLM from Archbishop Corleone, because you've never been there. It's something good to experience. So another good thing. Just the fact that it was a Eucharistic Congress is a good. We had to put that in the good category. Because remember, they could have done a convention, a conference. I mean, they could have done like some type of event. But they did a Eucharistic Congress. And that is a direct connection to the pre-Vatican II church. Because that's when they used to do Eucharistic Congresses. The last one done in America, national one, was in 1941. And they used to, you know, be huge events in the church. And so the fact they said, hey, let's look back at what was done in the past to see how we might be able to solve our problems of today. That's all we've been trying to say around here, is that let's look to the past, our tradition, to look for solutions to our problems today. And that's what they did. We'll get into execution. We'll get about some ways I don't think they did it that great, but the fact is that's a good thing. And they're talking about doing another Eucharistic Congress in maybe 10 years or something like that. So I think we have to recognize that. And there were aspects of it that are just inherently traditional. Adoration, processions, those things are just inherently traditional, and they are good, pious events. Activities that we should encourage. So again, praise to the having a Eucharistic Congress rather than just some generic event. That way it was very clear that you're going to have adoration, you're going to have processions, things like that. Also, there were some good speakers there. Scott Hahn was there, Patrick Madrid, Trent Horn, some others like that. Some good speakers there. I'm going to talk about the speakers a little bit more in a minute, and it's going to be under the bag category, unfortunately. But there were some good speakers there. Also, I just want to say that probably everybody there, or the vast majority of people who are attendees, are good, sincere Catholics. They're trying to grow in their faith. They're trying to draw closer to Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. That's a good. When you get Catholics who are serious about their faith, gathering together to worship the Lord in the Eucharist, How can you say that's a bad thing? I'm not going to say it's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. We can be critical about certain aspects of the event and emphasis and things they didn't talk about, stuff like that. Fine, I'll do that in a second. But the fact is, the people who were there, good, sincere, solid Catholics. And so that's a good thing. Okay, so that's kind of the good. Now I want to talk about what I'd say is the bad. And the things I have under bad, they're kind of, you know, some are worse than others. I'll just put it that way. Some are maybe nitpicking a little bit, and some I think are more serious problems. The first is there was the typical Protestant style music and kind of praise music there that kind of dominated. Now, I don't think I mentioned under the good, but there was one night, I think it was Thursday night, at the main event with adoration going on in the big stadium, they did have Gregorian chant, and they did have some beautiful traditional chant there. So I'm not saying it was all the time, but there was mostly the music was kind of the Steubenville experience music, which, I mean, it's the Steubenville effect. I mean, that their conferences they've been having for decades, that's the impact it has. This is just what you do. I mean, it would be almost unheard of for an official, like, institutional Catholic event not to have that music. They'd have to be a, you know, explicitly trad group or something like that not to have this type of music. But I still think, though, even though it's standard fare, status quo, I'm just not a fan. I mean, here's the thing. I don't even not like that music. I listen to that music sometimes, like in the radio or something like that. It's not like I'm like the music is the worst or anything like that. It's just, we have such a deep tradition in our church of sacred music that the fact that that's the dominant music just really just shows a rupture from the tradition of church. I mean, no institution has created more beautiful, inspired, more beautiful music than the Catholic Church. And yet we ignore 99.9% of it, and we throw out ditties from like the 70s and the 90s and the 2000s that are inspired by Protestant music. I just don't get that. I'm sorry, maybe it's an age thing. Although I don't think it is, because, I mean, young people are flocking to traditional Latin Mass with Gregorian chant and sacred music, things like that. But it just is something that you do. Now, note that there was some criticism when people saw some charismatic type stuff going on. That wasn't during Mass. That was during the adoration and things like that. I'm not praising it. I'm just simply stating there is a difference between having that music in Mass and having that music like at other times. Okay, so that's first thing I want to mention is there was too much of that, in my opinion. I mean, maybe I have one night with that kind of music, but every other night should be dominated by sacred music, by meaning like old traditional hymns and Gregorian chant and things like that. Instead, they kind of did it the reverse. They had one night that was more traditional, and the rest of the nights more of the Protestant Steubenville type music. Another thing, this is like a small thing, but like I noticed that like Cardinal Dolan celebrated a Mass, and they talked about it. If you register for the Congress, you got emails each day with like an update, and they featured Cardinal Dolan in his homily during Mass, in which he said that the Eucharist is a meal where we gather at the divine table to celebrate the saving action of our God. Really, we're still emphasizing the fact that the Eucharist is a meal, not the holy sacrifice on Calvary. Like, I'm not one who is like, you can't ever say it's a meal. I do understand that there are various aspects of the Mass and of the Eucharist, the Holy Sacrifice obviously being a main one, but also the Last Supper. I'm not claiming there's no meal aspects, but we have been emphasizing the meal aspects in the Catholic Church for decades now. And where has it got us? It's a casual, like it's basically like our meals at home with our family. We're just all casual. That's what we do at Mass. So I just thought that was like missing the point, Cardinal Dolan, that you emphasize that it was a meal rather than the Holy Sacrifice, or at least that's what they even emphasize. You might have said more. I didn't go to that Mass, but my point is this is what the organizers of the Eucharistic Congress emphasize about Cardinal Dolan's homily, which I thought was unfortunate. Okay. We're on the bad category, so let's talk about the speakers. In general, the speakers were exactly who you expected them to be. The most like safe and non-controversial speakers you could have. Not one of them. There was one I thought was controversial, but clearly they didn't think that. And I'll talk about her in a second. But like, it's the standard professional Catholics that you see at every event, that come to every event. And here's the thing is, the reason they are chosen is because they are safe. Not one of them is going to get up there and say, we need to institute communion on the tongue. Interesting aside on that, I gave some of my thoughts on Eucharistic Congress on the on X, and Bishop, and I mentioned something about this, and Bishop Strickland actually commented on it and said that he thinks that the bishop should remove the indult for communion in hand in America. That's why somebody, Bishop Strickland, is not invited to this event. Nobody there is going to say we need to have like communion rails, kneeling, receiving on the tongue. We need to all celebrate ad orientem, nothing like that. It just, you're not going to get it. And also there was the emphasis on celebrity. I do not understand. And I'm not saying it against this guy personally. I do not understand the big deal about Jonathan Rumi. I think that's how you pronounce the name. The guy who plays Jesus in The Chosen. I mean, he is the number one go-to speaker at a Catholic event anymore. Like, I'm not claiming he doesn't have a faith or isn't Catholic, anything like that. I don't know. What I am claiming, though, is why does he have a life experience that makes him a great speaker? Because he's a celebrity. I mean, basically, he's an actor. And in more civilized times, people didn't trust actors because an actor can act, which means they can act like anybody up there. You don't know when they're sincere. He might be very sincere, but I also know he's an actor. So I just don't get the, you know, there's a certain celebrity worship that goes on. And I think that's a problem. But my bigger complaint is simply the fact that they didn't have one speaker who's really going to go off script. And as we'll see, as I'm going to talk about here in a minute, we need to go off script. I mean, we need to go off script if we're really going to change the culture in the Catholic Church and have a true Eucharistic revival. I do want to mention one speaker in particular. And this was a speaker who was breakout session or a smaller session like that, because they allow those. This was at the main stage in Lucas Oil Arena or Stadium at night for the big one that everybody goes to. They had like top speakers for this, like Jonathan Rumi. They had, you know, Bishop Barron. They had Chris Stefanik, I think. They had people like that. They had Gloria Purvis as one of these. So it was only like about maybe a half a dozen or a dozen speakers on that level. And she was one of them. Now, if you're not sure, if you don't know who she is, she was an EWTN personality who got fired basically at EWTN. And she's an African-American woman who basically, after the George Floyd riots, the Summer of Love in 2020, she became a complete race baiter. I don't know another way to put it. If you follow her, and I don't follow her, but I see her posts on X, she is constantly claiming the Catholic Church is full of racism. She's constantly bringing up racist practices from the past and saying we need to repair them, but she doesn't ever say specifically how. Here's one example. This is from like a week or two ago. She was saying how it used to be that whites received communion before blacks at Catholic churches in America. Number one, I don't know if that's even true. I've never heard of that. But let's grant that it was true, at least at some places. Clearly, it wasn't a common practice, or else we'd all know about it. And it would have been such a huge deal to change. Maybe it happened in certain, you know, isolated instances. Well, she was bringing it up like, we need to repair this. What do you mean? We don't do it anymore. It's repaired. I mean, that's the repairing of it, is that we no longer have those practices in the church. And if anybody even tried a practice like that, they'd be condemned so harshly within the Catholic Church and so quickly. I mean, a priest who tried that would be run out of town like that, and everybody knows it. So we've solved the problem of having communion somehow segregated. But yet she wants this repair. But basically, then when you try getting specifics from her, she basically plays a passive-aggressive, you don't understand, you're racist, whatever. And they had this person as one of the featured speakers. One of the main featured speakers at this to talk about racism and whatnot. So I just thought that was a real problem, because it really, if your focus is Eucharistic, the Eucharistic Congress is belief in Eucharist, how does this solve anything? How does this help anything to have someone who's clearly a race baiter up there? Okay, so that's the speakers. Another that was under the bad, of course. Another thing is that I would, that, I mean, this is a small thing, but like, they gave you a ton of swag when you walked in. I mean, I have all this stuff. I'm going to throw it all away pretty soon, but you get all these booklets and different things while in a bag where you're there. And one of the main ones I noticed, like, as soon as I open it up, it has a featured article on a working mom. And it's like, is that really what we need to feature these days, is working moms? Don't we need to give a lot more support to those heroic mothers who stay at home with their children and raise them, who are, who their families are willing to sacrifice having only one income instead of two in order to, for the mom to be with her kids at all times? But instead, it's this idea that, you know, we got to like be modern, we got to be hip. I mean, it's the feminist influence, of course. And so it features like a working mom who works from home, I'm sure, and that makes it all better somehow. But it does mean that she's not spending full time with her children. And I just don't think that's something that should be a feature of something they're giving out at the Eucharistic Congress. Okay, so those are some specifics. The real problem, though, what I under the bad at the Eucharistic Congress was simply that it ignores the real issues in the Catholic Church when it comes to Eucharistic piety, Eucharistic devotion, belief in the real presence. It's simply ignoring them. Like I said, all the speakers there were all safe. They're not going to talk about any of the controversial things. I want to remind people that the origin of this Eucharistic Congress is the fact that the bishops didn't have the guts to deny communion to Joe Biden. I mean, that's just the reality. That's what set things off. Basically, they saw that people weren't believing in the real presence. There was talk about we need to deny communion to pro-abortion politicians like Joe Biden. There was a big fight in the USCCB. They was like, okay, we can't do that. We don't have support for that, but let's do something. So we're going to have this Eucharistic revival in the Eucharistic Congress. Now, again, God can use anything, you know, for his good. So I'm not saying that the whole thing is bad. I'm just saying, though, they were not going to bring that up. Nobody at the Congress is wrenching that we should not give communion to Joe Biden or other pro-abortion politicians. And because of that, we have this scandal. If we really believe it's the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, and that if we really believe St. Paul's words that you bring on condemnation on yourself if you receive unworthily, and then yet we still hand it out like a Pez dispenser to anybody and everybody, no matter what, including those who are in public in serious sin, it's a mixed message. We'll just put it that way. And so those are the type of thing. That's one example of what they're ignoring. They're ignoring the communion on the hand. I mean, when I went to the Eucharistic pilgrimage procession in Cincinnati, they had a mass before in the cathedral, and it was so full that people were standing outside. I was outside in the street outside of it because of the fact they couldn't fit everybody in the church. Great, right? But then, like, during communion, during Mass, they had speakers set up. Some priests just come out, stand on the street by themselves, and start handing out communion. There's no paten. There's no, like, umbrella or anything maybe to protect, you know, from elements or anything like that. It was a good day, but still. And then people were going up, and a lot of them were receiving in the hand. And I admit, because I go to the traditional Latin Mass each week, I'm not used to seeing that anymore. I mean, for 20 years, I attended the Novus Ordo regularly. I still attend it at times, but it's still somewhat shocking to me that at an event that's focused on devotion to the Eucharist, we have people receiving the hand outside on the street. I mean, anybody could have walked up, and it was just, and anybody, the host could have been dropped right there on the street. I mean, it just was a little bit shocking to me, to be honest, but we can't talk about that. Nobody's allowed to say that at the Eucharistic Congress, something like that. Nobody can make that criticism. Same with receiving kneeling, altar rails, ad orientem, all these things that are seen as just weird hangups of the trads, but they're essential. They're essential because, and here's the point, the most important point I'm trying to make here, is that I do not believe the bishops and most of the leaders of the Catholic Church understand how to pass on the faith. I am willing to say that most bishops want to pass on the faith, but they don't know how, because the faith isn't passed on simply by talking about it. It's passed on by osmosis, by living it and by seeing it all around you in so many different ways and having it come at you through all your different senses, through smell, through sight, through taste, from touch, all these different things. Because when the bishop saw, okay, we have a problem with belief in the real presence, their first thought was, I mean, the Congress is great, but it's like, let's get speakers to tell them they need to believe and why they need to believe. But that's not how you pass on the faith primarily. That's a part of it. It's a small part. It's primarily seen by growing up in a church that has beautiful architecture, that is fitting for a fitting location for the Mass and to hold the Blessed Sacrament. They have sacred music they hear each week. They see people receiving on the tongue, kneeling. They see adorantum worship. They see beautiful music that's surrounding all the celebration of the Mass. That's how you pass on the faith. That's how you pass on the faith. Not just having a couple events, every once in a while and talking about it. So what's happening is you have this Congress, which in all is a very good thing in a lot of ways. People get very enthusiastic, but then they go home to their parishes that are bland. They have bland music, bland architecture, bland artwork, bland homilies, people receiving on the hand, an army of older ladies handing out communion. All these people dressed like in shorts and t-shirts at Mass, things like that. All those things, it's not just hangups of old fogies like me. The reason it's a hangup, I should say, it is a hangup, I guess, is because we know that the faith is passed on through osmosis, meaning it's just like it's subconsciously done. It's not just, you tell somebody the faith and then they believe it. And so I really felt like that was a real problem. And let me give you an anecdote somebody told me. This is somebody who had a meeting, like in a small meeting group with a bishop. I won't say who the bishop is or anything like that. But during this, before the Congress, but during the whole Eucharist revival, and the bishop asked, and it's one of the better bishops, I'll put it that way, asked, how can we increase devotion to the real presence, to the Blessed Sacrament? And this guy told me what he said to him was, we need to require all priests to minister Jesus to us while we are kneeling and on the tongue. He didn't say we need traditional Latin Mass everywhere. We didn't say we need to, do something super radical. But instead, he just said we need to have priests, handing out, distributing communion to people who are kneeling on the tongue. What was the response of the bishop? One of the bishops who's a better bishop. I know who it is, but I'm not going to say who it is. Say, well, we really can't do that because it would take away pastoral autonomy. I mean, basically, that's in so many words, that's what he said. We just can't do that. Well, if we can't do that, we can't have a true Eucharistic revival. I mean, period, end of story. If we're not willing to do the kind of hardcore changes in Eucharistic piety itself, then we're not going to have a true Eucharistic revival. We're going to get some people excited. You're going to have some people who grow more in their faith through it, but you're not going to have a widespread, okay, this is a true revival happening in the church. And that's just the reality. And there's no other way to put it. And so until we're willing to address those issues, and remember, those issues were nowhere to be found at the Eucharistic Congress, nowhere to be mentioned. That was seen as something that if you do that, you're the bad guy who's putting a big damper on the Congress, everybody being excited. You're being the the negative Nancy there. But unless we can bring these things up and talk about them, really, address them directly, we're not going to have a Eucharistic revival. Okay, so that was the good, the bad. I want to talk about the ugly for a second. Okay, I just want to note, I am a free market capitalist through and through. I totally believe in the free market, totally believe in business. I totally believe in making money and needing money to support what you do. I have no problem with Catholics who do it for a living. I mean, I am one of them. And so they need money in order to do what they do. And if people support it, that's great. I want to make that very clear. That being said, there was something a bit distasteful about the over-commercialization of the Congress. I mean, the exhibit hall was huge, had over 1,000 booths there. And just so you know, 1 Peter 5, of which I'm kind of over 1 Peter 5, it had a booth there and I approved it. I'm not saying the people who had booths there were bad. I'm just saying, though, there was something about it that just was a bit distasteful for me. And I don't know exactly how to express it. I just was picturing, did the 1941 Eucharistic Congress have all these, commercial booths? I doubt it. I mean, some of them were huge as well. And so the connection was just a bit, I did not like it. I understand you have to pay the bills. And so you got to have these. And by the way, they were not cheap. Those booths were not cheap. I mean, I know some people who did not get booths because it was just too expensive. It wasn't worth it to them. And then like, you know, so let me find this page. I'm looking at the, this is something where I'm going to agree with, I guess I missed it. Okay, here we go. So I'm going to agree with some left Catholics here. So mark it down, put it on your calendar, let people know today is a day, July 23rd, 2024, I did this. I saw some more, let's say, progressive Catholics who were criticizing the fact that this is the National Eucharistic Congress like booklet, and it says Perpetual Adoration Chapel at John the Evangelist Church, Wednesday, 9 a.m. through Sunday at 9 a.m. This is the adoration I was talking about, which was very nice. It was in a beautiful church right across the street and packed all the time. Great. Right underneath it in kind of small print says, sponsored by Halo. Sponsored by Halo, which I had a podcast a few months ago talking about Halo and the problems, how that is. Basically, it's a multi-million dollar organization. It's raised a lot of venture capital, hundreds of millions of dollars through organizations that aren't even Catholic. And so there's some issues there. I just find that distasteful to have Perpetual Adoration Chapel sponsored by a company. I get you got to pay the bills. I get that like the church needed some reimbursement for what they were doing. And God bless the people at the church for hosting it. But having a sponsored by Halo there, I'm sorry. I'm with you, Mike Lewis and other, Don Eden, I think it was, and some others who were criticizing that on Twitter. I'm with you. I think that's kind of an ugly part of it because we're here. Again, I don't have a problem with companies being there, stuff like that, but I do think it was a bit over-commercialized. I think that's just the way things are, though. Like, I kind of recognize that. Like I said, they wouldn't have done that in 1941 because that's not how things were back then. You can't have an event that you don't have a ton of booths. You don't have, a very much a commercialization. That's how you pay the bills. That's how you keep the cost down for the attendees. But I think it was a little bit over the top. Okay. I'm almost finished here. So those who have stuck with me, I'm going to answer. We're getting some good comments in the live chat. I will address those here in a minute at the end. I do want to address though, real quick, the traditional Eucharistic revival that went on kind of as a counter event on the Friday during the Congress. What happened was LifeSite News and some others, they hosted a traditional procession and traditional Latin mass and some speakers at a local baseball field, the minor league team baseball field, which was right down the street from the Congress. And it was clearly a counter event to say, okay, that's what they're doing over there, but here's what traditional Catholics should be doing. I did not support that effort. I love John Henry Weston. And I think he's a good guy. I don't want to make it seem like I don't, but I thought this was a misstep. The main reason is Father James Altman was the celebrant at the mass and gave the talk and gave a homily. And I did not attend, but I know people who did. And the fact is that Father Altman is likely a sede vicantis. I mean, he's a little bit squirrely on it, but I don't think he thinks Francis is Pope. So did he even mention Francis in the canon when he prayed the mass? And if he didn't, that's not one that's in union with the Catholic Church. I mean, I'm not saying it's an invalid mass. It's not, but I am saying it's illicit and out of union. And so that's not something we should be encouraging. But I think my major problem, and I think an Archbishop Vigano, who's obviously excommunicated now, and I've had podcasts about that and written about that. He sent a video message to that event. And so to me, that seems very much setting up a counter church to the Catholic Church. And I think that's a mistake because the fact is that we need to reform the Catholic Church. That means an event like the Congress, we need to have a trad presence. That's why I was happy that 1 Peter 5 went, Mass of the Ages was there, some other more traditional groups were there, handing out flyers, talking to people about traditional pieties and things like that. That's the way it has to be done. We had a couple of traditional Latin masses there. I know that's not enough right now, but that's the path I think we have to go. So I just wanted to note that.
I'm not, yeah, I don't want to talk about it much more, but I was not a supporter of that effort because I think it set up at least visually and kind of subconsciously this idea of they're not the real church, we're the real church going on over here. And I don't think that's the way to go. I think we have to deal with the fact that the real church is in a lot of trouble right now, and we need to help reform it rather than saying we're going to set up something separate from it. So ultimately then, we have to ask, was it a success? I had a whole podcast about this over a month ago. There's a lot of post-Congress emotions going on right now. I've seen like some really over-the-top stuff. Like, you know, the church in America is going to be changed forever because of this. The church is a lie. The church is back. You know, this is going to bring about like such a radical transformation of the Catholic Church in America because it's Congress. Okay, let's slow our roll here a little bit. I mean, I hope that people are changed. But even like World Youth Day with the Pope coming in 1993 didn't do what any of that, although people thought it afterwards. And it was a success in a lot of ways. I think we have to measure success by long-term impact. Will we see an increase in Eucharistic devotion, Eucharistic piety? Or will we continue to see the same decline we have now? We can't expect a single event to really change that much, even if it's done perfectly. So I feel like a little bit like the people are riding on their high emotions from it and saying the church can change forever. That's not going to happen almost no matter what, no matter how well the Congress goes. That's really not going to happen. And like I said, because of the fact that they refuse to kind of address some of the real problems when it comes to Eucharistic piety in the church, I don't think it's going to have a huge long-term impact. My prayer is it does. Definitely help some grow in their devotion to the Eucharist, and I think that would be a great thing if it does. But too many people at that Congress are going to return to a bland parish that doesn't really foster Eucharistic devotion, and I worry for them what will happen to their own Eucharistic beliefs when they go there week in, week out, rather than have their mountaintop experience at the Congress. So. Okay, let me look at some of the comments, questions that were here. Okay, how many priests were there that never preach about the real presence from the pulpit? It's a good question. I think most of the priests there were pretty strong, solid. I mean, if they went to the Congress, they were there to, they were there because they believed in the real presence. And also, a lot of them came up to the 1 Peter 5 table. A lot of seminarians came up to Mass of the Ages table and talked to them about the Latin Mass. A number of them were at the TLM. So I do think the priests who were there were solid, you know, believers in the real presence of the Eucharist. I wanted to go, but this is from August TV 123. I wanted to go, but by the time I got to like page 7 of registration, realized it would be an 18-hour day for my 5-year-old and hardly anything for her to do there. Maybe we'll try again when she's older. Yeah, you know, I did see some people with smaller kids, but they were basically saying it was quite a sacrifice to be there. And it probably, you know, a 5-year-old, I would not have taken my, if I had a 5-year-old, I would not take a 5-year-old. So I don't blame you. Okay. Consecrated Soul says, Eucharistic revival is a band-aid without acknowledging the lex orandi of the church. Nothing will change. And that is true. I think I wouldn't necessarily say as strong as you, nothing will change. I think there could, like I said, could be individual change, but you're essentially right. I think it is a band-aid on a bullet wound. We have, you know, we're bleeding out the churches because of so many factors. And it's not like the Congress isn't doing anything, but it's not really getting to the lex orandi, which is what she's mentioning, you know, he or she, Consecrated Soul, is mentioning. And I think that's a great point that you're making. Also from Consecrated Soul, Catholics who attend the TLM, 99% believe in the real presence. Catholics who attend Nosora, 30% believe in the real presence. I think it's actually less than that. The solution is right in front of us. Okay, I think some people will immediately say that's selection effect. That basically, if you go to the Latin Mass, you already believe in the real presence. That's why you get 99%. It's not the Latin Mass itself that's causing you to have it. That's the objection to this statement. I think there's some validity to it, but not all. First of all, why is it that those who believe in the real presence end up gravitating towards the traditional Latin Mass? Because of their belief in the real presence, they want to see it treated with the respect and reverence and adoration it deserves. So they end up leaving their bland Novus Ordo parish to go to traditional Latin Mass, or at least they go to a much more reverent traditional Novus Ordo. So I do think, while you could say that's a selection effect, but that kind of proves the point. So Okay, M5 Guitar 1 says, we can't insist on kneeling and on the tongue. This is an outrage. Yeah, I agree. I mean, we should be able to insist on it, but that's not where we are right now. John F. Kennedy, hey, back from the dead. John F. Kennedy says, that response is no surprise. They want to just keep it that way it is. And that talking about the bishop saying they just can't change that. Okay, and then finally, Joseph Clark says, Anglicans receiving kneeling on the tongue, it's not even Jesus. You know, there are definitely a good segment of Anglicans, especially the Anglo-Catholics, who do receive. I remember this. I remember one time years ago, I went to a family member's, high Anglicans, they were baptizing their kid. I went to the, and it was like their service, and it looked a lot like a traditional Latin mass. And they were kneeling and on the tongue a lot. Anglicans do that. So, I mean, if they can do that, why can't we? So I think ultimately, though, I'm praying for that the Eucharistic Congress will truly change lives. I'm also praying, though, that Catholic bishops in particular and priests recognize that we need to talk about the elephant in the room, which is the lack of Eucharistic piety in our devotions, in the way we treat Jesus in the Eucharist, in, you know, receiving in the hand, not kneeling, all those different things. Until we really get to those root problems, we're not going to have a true revival. Okay, I think I'm going to end it there. I appreciate everybody who joined the live chat. Until next time, everybody, God love you.